This was the essence of Prince's design for the raid. In the pitch dark, with so much thunderous gunfire and scurrying back and forth, it might appear to be a melee, but it was all to be carefully choreographed, with the major action of the raid taking no more than 30 minutes. Organized confusion was how Prince described it. We wanted all hell to break loose, he said, but to break loose precisely on our terms. The captain was confident in the broad strokes, but what concerned him was the high level of coordination that the plan required without benefit of any sort of dry run. It was a sustained and intensive collaboration involving so many disparate groups, Rangers, Scouts, two separate guerrilla organizations, Filipino civilians, POWs, not to mention the lowly, shambling water buffalo. All told, the raid would employ a cast of nearly 1,000 characters, every one of whom had to do his job and do it correctly, or else the mission hung in jeopardy. The individual tasks seemed straightforward enough, but taken as a whole, the operation had to unfold as an intricate progression, each action building on the success of the previous one, each stage driving ineluctably toward the next, like tricky interlocking patterns of tipping dominoes. It was such a complex group of people, none of whom had had any real dealings with one another before, not on such a scale, Prince said. The main thing that made it conceivable to think we could succeed was that we were in friendly territory with friendly people. Trying to do that somewhere else, I don't think you could even come close. Prince and Musi would give the platoon leaders wide latitude in assigning the teams and ordering specific tasks to be performed by their subordinate enlisted men. Of all the different components of the plan, what worried the platoon leaders most was the approach itself. That long, slow crawl to the gate gave off a faint whiff of suicide. The Japanese would still have ample light to see the Rangers as they wriggled to their final positions in the fields. How could the men expect to escape the notice of the guards? It seemed an insoluble problem. Here, Captain Pahota spoke up. Over the past few weeks, he said, his guerrillas had noticed something interesting. It appeared that the Japanese guards at the camp were unusually agitated by the specter of American planes flying overhead. The planes would roar into view, and even if they were just innocuous little Piper Cubs, the guards would excitedly scour the skies. Why not call in a few American planes to buzz the camp in the last moments leading up to the raid, purely as a diversion? It might distract the Japanese sentries just long enough for the Rangers to sneak into their positions. Instead of looking down, the guards would be looking up. No shooting, no bombs, said Pahota. Just fly over. Musi instantly liked the sound of it. As with Pahota's suggestion of using Carabao carts, the idea was novel, even a little odd, yet at the same time compellingly simple. Air cover not as a defense, but as a decoy, a gaze averter. The aircraft would just be up there, looping and droning and turning, flummoxing the guards, commanding their attention. It might at least buy the Rangers more time. Musi felt it was well worth breaking radio silence to request that 6th Army headquarters scramble a plane. The mighty U.S. Army was not always known for its lightning reflexes, however, and at this late hour it seemed unlikely that a plane and pilot could be assigned in time to do any good. Still, Musi decided it was worth a try. He had the radio operator call in the request. In back of all the many doubts and contingencies Musi had to grapple with, one outcome seemed certain. With an assignment as perilous as this, there were bound to be casualties. Musi made sure Dr. Jimmy Fisher, the battalion surgeon, was well prepared. Fisher had spent the better part of the day turning the one-room schoolhouse of Platero into a makeshift hospital. Fisher had befriended a local Filipino doctor, Carlos Nugid Layug, who agreed to help conduct surgeries, dress wounds, and do whatever else was needed. Trained in Manila before the war, the 37-year-old Layug was an experienced army physician from the Bataan battlefields, a survivor of the death march, in fact, and he'd spent the past 3 years surreptitiously serving as the surgeon for Captain Pahota's insurgents. During those years, he had encountered just about every sort of trauma and malady the war could throw at a young doctor, and he'd learned to work miracles with scant supplies, rudimentary equipment, and no money whatsoever. When Liuk treated patients, he was usually accompanied by his wife, Julita, who was also a surgeon, every bit as competent and resourceful as he.